Okay, y'all ready?
One more session. So y'all thought with Eileen's section this morning, oh, this is going to be all easy, everything I've seen before. We needed to change that. So this is the final session of the day. We have a little bit of time. If you guys want to chat or ask specific questions or whatever, reserved after this. But if we, I guess I haven't been the best about ending early. But if we do end early, you guys are welcome to take off and go commiserate over a beer after using Unix for the first time. So this last session, again, of the day, and just, I guess, before I forget, some brief announcements about tomorrow. So tomorrow morning is lab safety. So for those of you who are who've already been through the departmental or the graduate student lab safety or the chemical safety training, don't feel like, you won't hurt my feelings if you don't show up. For those of you who are starting new or who haven't been through the chemical safety training yet, they do keep a record, particularly if you're going to be working here. I mean, Chloe, you're stuck. But EHS does keep a record, and in principle, if you go through it tomorrow, you don't have to do it again. And so I would certainly recommend it for like Becca and anybody who's starting out as a graduate student. And I think it's required if you're going to be actually doing research this summer, if you haven't taken it yet. But like I said, if you've been through Aaron Keese's session already, no need to do it again. Unfortunately, Aaron has left the university. She's on to bigger and better things. She's still in Starkville, so you might still see her around. She did a wonderful job with this. So I'm hoping that whoever they have replacing her is also going to do a wonderful job. But it's lab safety, so it's. I was very impressed when I first saw Aaron do it. I was like, wow, that was the best lab safety thing I ever saw. Anyway, so that's tomorrow. I think that's all morning. There might be a brief session. It'd be good if I knew my own program. Yeah, so there's no breakfast tomorrow, sorry. There's lab safety from 9 to 12, and so that's the morning. They do finish pretty close to 3 hours, so you might get out a little bit early, but it should stay on schedule. And then if you're skipping the lab safety, then we pick up again at 1:30. Okay. With DNA. And so that might be, that's going to be another sort of introductory DNA structure type of things. There are plans to talk about, calculating temperature, melting temperatures, things like that. But there's also going to be, this is DNA structure too. Okay, so today's final session is essentially on model fitting. We're going to look at a particular program called NewPlot. Again, this is a freely available software package. That's why I include it. It's statistically robust enough that it can get you error bars. So if you have to do any kind of model fitting, it's useful. Certainly, there are lots of programs available that will fit a model to data and give you uncertainties and error bars and things like that. But again, the purpose of this workshop is to try to keep things cheap, try to keep things easily accessible for you guys. And so NewPlot is not the best software to use, but it's free, and it does a reasonably good job, and you can generate publication quality data for it. So if your advisor says, no, we use Origin in this lab, use Origin, but hopefully the concepts that we're teaching today, they apply to NewPlot, but they also apply to other things as well. Okay, so the first thing that we're going to discuss, and this is going to be another one where you guys sit and talk with your neighbors. So introduce yourself to your neighbor again, if you've forgotten their name. Nobody will be embarrassed. And so I want you to think about this question, what is a scientific model? And before you just jump ahead to the next slide, but try to do some talking about it and see what you come up with, and we'll get some brainstorms here after a minute or two.
I was thinking about becoming a scientific model.
What?
Stones.
I said I was thinking about becoming a scientific
model.
Just
regardless. Oh, yes. Okay, discuss. I'm not going to stand in your way. I will sit down and come back in 3 minutes.
What do you think?
What music was this? Like the theme song for CSI or something. Something like a simple framework to explain how some particular system works. Mm-hmm. Okay, so simplicity is good. Anybody else have other things?
It's kind of what we said. We were talking about it, how it was like a simplified version of a system, because everything we do is not necessarily how it actually is out wild.
It's something that we have to use comparison with whatever. There's so many different types of models. It's a broad question.
Okay.
But,
well, that brings up another good point. It's limited, right?
Yeah,
exactly. So unless you're a physicist, I'm assuming you're a physicist friend, and you're trying to come up with a theory of everything. Generally, if you the Bohr model of the atom is not going to explain fluid dynamics. Maybe you could, but in general, you're not going to the Bohr model of the atom applies to the model of the atom. It's not, it's limited in scope. Out of necessity, because unless you're trying to do the theory of everything, you're trying to come up with something that's very concise and
specific,
limits to a particular system.
Other stuff. Anything about prediction?
Yeah, like extrapolation of data, depending on what you, if it's like a mathematical model.
Right. Yeah, so if you make a model, you know, even if you make a simple model of the solar system, right? That should make some kind of prediction about the orientation of planets relative to one another. And a model is, if you can't make any kind of prediction about, you know, if you make these observations and your model is only limited to the observations you've already made, it's probably not going to be terribly useful if that's all you can do. I mean, the utility of a model is to say, okay, I've made these observations, but under this particular different circumstance, if I set up something new, I can make a prediction about how my system is going to behave in that new situation. Okay? Did you have something like that? Okay. So predictive is another one. And so we've been talking about general sort of models, like the model of the solar system. Maybe that's not so easy to represent mathematically, but you know, from a chemist or a biophysical or a biological even perspective, generally when you think about a model, you're thinking about limiting the scope, so limited scope, to a specific set of parameters. So like the Bohr model of the atom might have the lowest energy radius as a parameter, for example, or it might have something more fundamental than that. Okay, but generally, when you think about a mathematical model, you're thinking about, you know, what is this? How can I get this list of observations into a set of a few parameters that I can then, you know, use those parameters to make predictions about other things. Okay, and so in thinking about it from that point of view. Things like an equilibrium constant are a parameter, right? So my equilibrium constant, you know, I might have, suppose I'm thinking about binding, two molecules coming together and forming some kind of interaction, right? If my equilibrium constant is big, that's going to favor binding. If my equilibrium constant is small, that's going to favor, you know, the unbalanced state. Okay, so in that sense, the equilibrium constant is a single number that describes whether binding is tight or whether binding is weak. And so in that sense, it's a parameter. Now, you guys have thought about the equilibrium constant as something fundamental to chemistry for your entire lives, well, since you took chemistry. But in a real sense, the equilibrium constant is just a fudge factor that we made up that describes whether binding happens tightly or whether binding doesn't happen. Okay, and so when we think about models from a biophysical point of view,
you know, generally, we're trying to think of a system of mathematical relationships or maybe even something as simple as a single equation that allows us to explain an observable quantity. And so in that sense, it could be anything as something that explains the absorbance we get for the for a particular concentration of a protein. Okay, so the extinction coefficient, it's a parameter. And it's explaining absorbance, so it's explaining an observable quantity. Other types of observable quantities might be the fraction bound or the amount of heat emitted from a reaction. Bacterial growth rate is an observable quantity. And then we express that quantity in terms of understandable parameters. So something that's simple. A model isn't useful if you have 15,000 different, you know, parameters that it could be affected by. Okay? People don't, the reason we still teach the Bohr model of the atom is because it essentially has, you know, one or two parameters. I think Rydberg constant would be one of them. And that's pretty much it. You know, if the Bohr model of the atom
had 30 different parameters that were needed to explain the absorption lines, that it wouldn't be terribly useful. Okay, so you want understandable parameters and fundamental constants. Okay, so things like pi, speed of light, the Boltzmann constant, those types of things are okay. And then it should be predictive, so we can test the model. You know, if you can't test the model, there's no point. And so whenever you come up with a model, you should be thinking about, you know, what types of experiments could I do that might allow me to test this model and see if it still applies. Okay, and so think about this from chemical equilibrium. So I know we're in a chemistry department. Some of you may or may not like chemistry. But if we have A plus B goes to C. Now, I'm not going to do this, but you know that if we, and suppose this has an equilibrium constant, right? If I tell you the initial concentrations of A and B, maybe you can't do it right now, but you could go back to your Gen Chem book and look up an ice table and tell me the concentrations of A and B at equilibrium, right? So you can, based on the framework of equilibrium thermodynamics, you can predict the concentrations of A and B at equilibrium, whether you have 1 molar A, 2 molar B, or 2 molar A, 1 molar B. Okay, so in that sense, this whole equilibrium framework that you guys have learned since freshman year chemistry, you've been learning about models and parameters, and you've been doing predictive model fitting from the get-go. Okay, so this is, it requires a little bit of a shift in how you think about things, but fundamentally, there's nothing different here. It's just that now you're thinking about it as a model. And while equilibrium thermodynamics is something that's so basic and fundamental to our understanding of chemistry today that it might not be easy to think of it as a model because it just works, to the early people like Le Chatelier, it certainly was, you know, there was no guarantees, right? It, at that time, it was definitely a model. It's like, well, let's see if we come up with a way to describe how this stuff is working. Okay, and so just because it's established doesn't mean that it's a model, right? You know, we have the model of the planets or the model of the solar system. I mean, it's still a model even though we know it to be accurate. Okay, and so in that sense, when we think about models, in this case, we should be thinking about equations, parameters, and how those equations and parameters can be related to observable values. Okay, and that's the physicist way of thinking about a model, and that's why, you know, it's probably not presented as much in chemistry departments, which is sad, but that's the way it is. Okay, so we're going to use a physical model, but hopefully not something that's too foreign to you guys as we think about models here today. And this is basically radioactive decay of barium, and so you could imagine that if you have a Geiger counter, this is a relatively fast decay. But as the nucleus decays into simpler stuff, you see that there's fewer radioactive decays or fewer radioactive events, disintegrations per second in this case, until eventually here at long time periods, you have, you know, nothing decaying, or, you know, the background radiation. Right, so you know, we don't exist in a vacuum. There is background radiation here, and so you have to, if you're thinking about accurately describing how barium decays in this particular way, you have to account for the fact that there's some level of background radiation. Okay, and so we can come up with a simple way or a simple model for describing this radioactive decay. Okay, now, again, this is a little bit maybe more complicated than it needs to be. But our observable here would be related to the counts, so the counts that we're observing. And our parameters, or our functional form, would be some constant times this exponential function, so e to the minus something times t, plus the background radiation. Okay? And so this is our model in this particular situation. Our model is simply an equation. And we've related it so that we have several comprehensible parameters that we can talk about and make sense of later on. The first one is our initial radiation, so the starting point. Note that if time is equal to zero, the initial counts that we see is the starting number plus the background radiation. Okay? The second parameter is the background radiation itself. So if time t goes to infinity, this guy goes to zero, and we're left with the counts being equal to the background radiation. And then the final parameter is the half-life. And again, I've just done some logarithmic tricks to get this represented as the half-life here. So don't get stressed out about the 0.6931. It's essentially just a way to get this in half-life instead of a characteristic time, which is what physicists usually do. Okay, so we have our observable, the number of counts, and we have three different parameters. Okay? And you can imagine if I were trying to make a prediction, you know, my observable is recorded at distinct or discrete time intervals. You know, here it looks like it's every 20 seconds or so. What if I wanted to predict the time here at, you know, time t equals 895, right? So I haven't actually recorded my time there. So that involves making a prediction, right? I've only recorded here maybe, you know, 850, 875, 900, but I haven't actually made a recording there at 895. Okay, and so one way that you can imagine is trying to fit a nice smooth line through all these points and making a prediction that way. Another way you could do it is just connect each point by a straight line and simply say, okay, well, if I'm trying to make a prediction at this point, I could just, you know, draw a straight line between those two points and interpolate between them. That doesn't seem like it makes the most sense here, right? Because this guy's a little bit higher than all the other ones. So you can imagine maybe doing a rolling average or something along those lines too. But the point is, if I'm going to use this model, I need to have some way of optimizing the parameters of my model to maximize the agreement with my observed data. Okay, if it makes sense that there's exponential decay of my radioactive counts, then that's a function that gives me exponential decay, but I don't know what my values of A, B, and T 1 half are. Okay, so here's where the computer comes in to help you. Because the computer has ways to optimize this kind of stuff. And as part of our sort of introduction here, we're going to sort of simulate what the computer is actually doing when we do our worksheet.
So one of the things, now you guys don't have this because there's no way to print out an Excel. Well, you can print out an Excel worksheet, but there's no way to print it out so you can work with it. But if you go to the website, there we go. Okay, so if you go to the website, you'll find an Excel spreadsheet with the same data that we've been looking at. Okay, and in that Excel spreadsheet, you have several different worksheets. I guess it's an Excel workbook. one of which contains the data itself, one of which contains just the graph of the data, one of which contains the graph with our model values. So right now we're not doing so hot. And then one of them contains something called the residuals, and we'll get to those in a little bit. Okay? But the point is, what I've done here is I've essentially taken that model that we have. So let me put it back on the screen. There we go. That's perfect. So I've taken our model, and in this model we have three parameters, A, T1 half, and B. Okay, now to make this a little easier, I have A, T1 half, and B. Now it's not strictly speaking the same A, but just pretend that it is. And then we have some additional information here, but these are the things that essentially you can imagine. If this is my model, and I were sitting here and I wanted to give you a model that made a good predictive value of the data, I would have to sit here and change these model parameters so that my red line, so that my red line here goes through the points, right? And so that's essentially all model fitting is. You come up with an equation that's supposed to describe your data and that makes physical sense. And then that equation has several parameters. And you try to optimize the parameters so that your predictions make the most sense with the observed data that you have. Okay, and so what we're going to try to do here is we're going to try to do this manually. Just as sort of an example to show you what a computer is actually doing when it does it digitally. Okay, so right now, if I look at my data and I think about my model, I can immediately make a couple of guesses. Right? If I look here at my background radiation or the stuff after everything is decayed, you know, I'm looking here in the background region, and it makes somewhat sense. I mean, what would you guys say the background radiation would be? 10. Seems reasonable. It's not going to be 50, right? Because if it were 50, I would expect it to decay to about here. You know, it's not going to be 0 because it's bigger than that. So I can immediately make a little guess about my background radiation. Let's say it's about 10. So I'll go over here to my data plot, and I'll change my background from 0 to 10. Yeah, that's not bad. Now, I'm still decaying too fast, right? The half-life is still way too short to describe this. And then the other thing is my initial time point, you know, my starting value, my A, is way too low. Right now my A is 60, and it probably should be up here in the, you know, 160 to 170 range. So let's go change that. So my initial height plus background, let's make that 160. And so now the only thing to do is try to adjust my half-life so that I make my line go through as many points as I possibly can. Okay, and so we can do that just as easily as anybody else. We'll go here. Let's try making it 100. Let's see what that does. That's closer. Make it 150. That might be a little bit too long. Right? You guys agree? that's not bad. That's actually, I'd say let's leave it for that. So that's reasonable, right? And we'll talk about what makes this a reasonable fit versus what makes other things a reason, what makes things unreasonable. But just looking at it, you know, it doesn't go through every single black circle, right? We wouldn't expect it to. You know, there's statistical noise, and so we're seeing a distribution of points up and down. They have an error bar associated with them. But by and large, you know, it's close to most of the black points, and it's certainly within the error bars for many of these black points, meaning that my line at any given particular observation is no more than one error bar away. Right? You all would agree with that? Okay, so essentially, what we've just done is we've proposed a model. We've said, okay, radioactive decays exponentially with a half-life, and there's a background and there's a starting amount of radiation. And we've looked at some data for this particular isotope of barium, and we've adjusted our parameters manually to try to optimize the agreement of our observed value and the model predictions. Okay? Now, that's hopefully to all of you, that seems very non-quantitative, right? We haven't really used any kind of quantitative number here. But fundamentally, that's all we're doing. That's all we're doing in any model, okay? The distances in your model of the solar system are chosen so that the interplanetary distances agree with Kepler's law, right? It's not like those distances are known to precise angstrom level. You know, the model of the solar system is fairly precisely known, but you can reach a limit of the precision. And essentially, you're taking a system of planets and you're trying to figure out what are the masses and the distances between the planets that gives you the observed laws of motion. Now, that's a difficult multi-body problem. But fundamentally, I mean, conceptually, that's what we're doing here. We're just having a simpler model with only three parameters and a simpler system of data. Now, what would happen? What do you guys think would happen if instead of having 50 observations or so, we only had two?
It's
not
going to be accurate.
Yeah, it's not going to be accurate, right? If we only have two data points, we have three parameters, and so, you know, this is a situation where we would say that we're overfitting our data. You know, if you have a certain number of parameters, the smallest number of data points that you can collect and get reasonably accurate values for your parameters is the same number as your number of parameters. So if we have three parameters, we need to collect three data points at the very, very minimum if we wanted to get any kind of accurate idea of what those parameters are. And you can look at that. I mean, if you could say, you know, if I threw out everything except this data point, and maybe this data point, you know, that would be the bare minimum that we would need if we wanted to have any kind of accurate estimation of the real half-life or the real background radiation or the real starting amount of radiation. Okay, so that's a fundamental rule of model fitting, is that if you're going to have a model with a certain number of parameters, you need at least that many observations to make an accurate estimation. You guys all know this, though. I mean, that sounds highfalutin and fancy, but you all know that you can't fit a line through a single point, right? If you have a line, there's two parameters, the slope and the intercept. You need two points to fit the slope and the intercept from a line. Now, there's a joke that there are some scientists out there that can take a single point and fit a line through it. But that's not us. We don't strive to be that. We want to have as many observable data points as we can so that we can test our model in as many situations as possible. And again, now if you want to make the prediction
about how many radioactive decays you would expect to see here at 895, you have a mathematical equation. You could take the value of your parameters, A, T1 half, and B, plug in 895 seconds, and see what the predicted number of counts are. Okay, so there's nothing special about, you know, model fitting or determining the value of parameters. And this is something I encourage for my students to do anyway, is, you know, if you're stumped and you don't know how a particular system or how a particular set of equations is going to behave, just go into Excel and set up a function and see what it looks like. You know, you guys could all go and take this data form, and you could do the exact same thing. I mean, there's nothing, I mean, this is basic, it's not basic Excel formulas, but I teach it in my sophomore level tools class, and so it's not hard formulas. Maybe it means you have to Google a few things and look up some stuff, but fundamentally speaking, you could go through and pick this up in an afternoon. So the question is, we've all done this manually now. How does a computer do it? Okay? You know, so far we've been very non-quantitative. We've sort of said, oh, that looks like a good fit. But probably, you know, if I were to make this 139, you know, you guys probably can't really tell the difference between that value and 140. Okay, so we need a computer in this particular situation to help us in determining what the values of these parameters should be. And in order for that to happen, what we need, what we really need, is some quantifiable way to measure the goodness of fit. Ideally, we'd want a number that was very, very small, like zero, if our fit was perfect. And we want that number to be extremely large if our fit was really bad. Okay? And that the reason we would want that is because a computer is very good at numbers. You know, you can tell a computer, is this number bigger or less than? And even if we, you know, even if we just had the dumbest algorithm in the world, high school student guessing numbers, okay? Not to say high school students are dumb, but suppose you just had a high school student rolling a dice. Or even make a monkey rolling a dice. Okay, let's not be mean to high school students. Let's just say monkey rolling a dice. And they roll the dice three times. And if you get a 1, a 6, and a 5, then you're going to use that as your half-life. Okay? Even if we had that kind of algorithm, as long as we could assess whether our fit got better or whether our fit got worse, we could still have a computer figure out how to optimize or figure out the best value for the half-life. Okay? But if you don't have a way to say, this is the number for this fit, and it's better than the number for this fit, then you're dead in the water. And so we need a metric, or we need some way to quantify whether a fit is good or bad. And so the way we do that is called chi-squared. Now, how many of you have heard of chi-squared before? Okay, that's actually good. It's a good number. All chi-squared is a metric for assessing goodness of fit. Okay? Chi-squared is big if the fit is bad. Chi-squared is small if the fit is good. And the one exception, or the one unique feature to chi-squared, is that it has a component that weights our fit based on the uncertainty. So if you're extremely uncertain about a value of a particular point, or if your error bar for that point is very, very large, you're not going to use that, you're not going to weight that point as much, or give that point as much consideration in your fitting algorithm. Okay, but essentially this is the equation for chi-squared. Okay, it's written here as a sum. Again, I know some chemists hate math, so I apologize for that. But you're a chemist, suck it up. But essentially what we're doing is, if we have 100 data points or 100 observations, we have the calculated value of our model. So this would be C in our previous example. So this is the calculated model, value of our model at a particular time point. This is the actual observed value of our model at that particular time point. And we take the difference. So if this is our first time point, we take the difference of our observed value and the model value. And the difference could be positive or negative. Okay, and so that's not good, because if it can be positive or negative, you know, a big difference here could cancel out with another big difference over here of opposite sign. And so we square. So if our difference is big, whether it's positive or negative big, it's going to give us a big value for chi-squared. If our difference is small, then it's going to give us a small value for chi-squared, regardless of whether it's positive or negative. We sum that up, and we divide by the uncertainty, or the standard deviation, or however you want to quantify that point. For most of our experiments, it would be standard error of the mean. But again, if your standard error of the mean is big, you have a big uncertainty associated with a particular data point, you divide by a big number, that means that this contribution to the chi-squared is small. It has a small weight. If it has a very, very small, or if that number is very, very precisely known, then you divide by a small number that's bigger, and you weight that value more. Okay? And so I talked about this for the first data point, so now you go for the second data point, and you add it to the value for the third data point, and you keep doing that for, you know, in this particular case, all 50 data points. Okay, and so if the disagreement is large for all 50 data points, chi-squared is going to be big. If the disagreement is small for all 50 data points, chi-squared is going to be small. If there's zero difference between our model and our observed observed value on our model, then chi-squared is going to be zero. Okay, so this is the metric that we want. We want something that's going to be small if the fit is good and big if the fit is bad. Chi-squared fits that. Now, there's all sorts of other statistical stuff about this that we don't have time to go into, but let's just say this is a really great function. Okay, so it's a great function. And now, if I look here at my fitting of radioactive decay, you can see it's given me values of A, B, and T 1/2. The final value of chi-squared, normalized chi-squared, is 0.43. Now, here I've put in the degrees of freedom. We didn't talk about that, so we should talk about that. Okay, so we didn't talk about the degrees of freedom, and essentially what the ND, or the number of degrees of freedom, is doing is it's trying to prevent you from the situation where you're using two points to fit a straight line. Okay, so if I have two observations and two parameters, the number of degrees of freedom is going to be zero. And so that means that that value is going to be zero. You're dividing by zero. It says, hey, chi-squared is no good here, because, you know, there's only one solution, and it's not like you're getting any information out from those points. Okay, so again, the more observations you can have relative to the number of parameters that you have, the better, and the more useful chi-squared will be as a measure of uncertainty. Okay, so we look here. So this is going into Excel. Now, how many of you have used Excel's solver? Oh, there you go. So we have some people who've used Excel's solver. Again, we're not going to do this because, again, it's covered in nuplot. And so, again, the nuplot, you know, maybe if I had to rework this session, I would do it. But really, where the rubber meets the road. So what the purpose of this module is to sort of give you enough background information so that you can work through this new plot tutorial and understand what the heck is going on. But so the model optimization can be done in new plot, but it can also be done in Excel if you're a particularly savvy Excel user. Okay, and so if I go over here and look at my model parameters again,
You know, here I have the degrees of freedom calculated, and there's also reduced chi-squared. And so now I don't even really have to look at the graph, right? I can just make changes and see if it makes... See if it makes... if I can type. See if my changes in parameters makes my reduced chi-square go up or down. Okay, so if I lower my T1/2 to 135, that's no good. Yeah, it's really not getting much better. 138, 132. So 135 is actually pretty close. And I can also change my background and see if that makes it go up or down. So that's worse. That's slightly worse. So you can see that by changing these numbers and monitoring whether chi-squared goes up or down, I'm essentially mapping out a surface for chi-squared. So this might be a little hard to visualize, but... I'm afraid to put this projector. If you turn off the projector, you're dead in the water. You have to restart the whole system. It's really kind of sad. But okay, so let me do my hand waving argument. So imagine we're working with two dimensions, and we're only modifying T1/2 and the background radiation. Okay, so x-axis is going straight back to the projection room. Y-axis is going over here towards the door, okay? So, and if I move along the y-axis, I'm changing the number of background radiation, or the amount of background radiation. If I move along the x-axis, I'm changing my half-life, okay? And imagine, now this room doesn't have a flat floor, which is sad, but, well, it's not bad, but imagine if this room had a flat floor, and I could walk around, and the value of my hand would be the value of chi squared for that particular combination of background radiation and half-life. Okay, so up here, maybe if background radiation is 0 and half-life is 10 seconds, my chi squared is going to be super, super high, maybe on the third floor somewhere. But as I walk around, my chi squared is going to get lower, and eventually, it's going to reach a minimum, right? So essentially, my chi-squared surface is going to be like a little hill or a valley. And so if I started my golf ball up here at the top where chi-squared was super, super high, and let it go, it would eventually minimize to find the minimum value of chi-squared. Okay, so that's really all we're doing. We have this surface in three dimensions, so really in four-dimensional space. But think two dimensions where you have x being your background and y being your half-life. And so you have a surface, and you're trying to find the minimum value on that surface. Okay, and so Excel, using the solver functionality, has a way to do that kind of a minimization. It's essentially the same kind of calculation that you would do if you were trying to find, you know, where a golf ball would stop on a hill. Okay? Digital minimization is beyond the scope of this class, but let's assume that there are programs out there that do it. Excel has the solver functionality. Nuplot has its own functionality that's a little bit more robust, in my opinion. Okay? But essentially, it's the same problem. Different types of computer algorithms that are implemented to solve the same type of problem. Ultimately, you're just finding the combination of parameters that give you the minimum value in chi-squared. And so Excel Solver, if you've used it before, you can basically say, change these cells to minimize a target cell. And so if your Excel workbook has automatically calculated chi-squared, and your parameters are set up in a way that you can change them individually, you can just set Excel solver on it. And now you have a way to optimize the parameters of any particular model that you've derived. Now, why do I like Nuplot better? Well, because, you know, if we go back to our golf ball metaphor, you know, all of our measurements have a certain uncertainty. And so if we really do have a golf ball and we have some kind of uncertainty in our surface resulting from the big error bars we have here, then it's not exactly going to be 100% clear, you know, what precise value of half-life you have. There's going to be an uncertainty associated with your half-life because you have an uncertainty associated with your data points. And Nuplot gives you a way to estimate that uncertainty that Excel Solver doesn't let you do. Okay? I mean, you can do it with Excel Solver, but you have to have some more complicated equations in there. Okay, so if I put this in the Nuplot and said, hey, give me a half-life, it's going to give me a half-life . So it'll tell me the half-life for is 144.6 seconds plus or minus 0.2 seconds or something like that. And that's a very useful number to have because you always want to express how certain you are whenever you report a particular number that you observed. Okay, so Nuplot can give you that. And as you work through this tutorial, you'll be able to see precisely how. Okay? So, there's nothing magic to it. You don't have to know how to program. You know, and if you follow the instructions there, you can use any particular model that you've derived and get out the uncertainty in your model fit. Okay, so let's keep on going with the presentation. Okay, so this is what we just talked about. I'm not going to go over that again. But the question is, so now pretend you've gone home, you've read the Nuplot tutorial, so you've done your homework, so to speak. Okay, and so the question is, how do you assess whether, you know, Nuplot gives you a fit, they give you some values of the parameters. The question is, how do you know whether the fit's good? You know, you've done all this work, and Nuplot gives you some numbers. You have a value for chi-squared. You know the value for chi-squared is lower. The lower the value for chi-squared, the better. But, you know, what does that mean? I mean, is my fit good enough? Okay, so here, the remainder of this module, we're going to talk about how you would look at a particular fit and, you know, determine whether it's adequate. Is it worthwhile, or is it worthy of bringing to your advisor during your weekly meeting? So, the first thing that you want to look at is simply, doesn't the fit look good? Okay, and this is what we did when we did our manual stuff. This probably should be your acid test. But we'll show you the other tests too. But here what you're looking for is, you know, do the points seem to fall on the line that you've predicted? You know, yes, you don't expect every single point to fall on the line, but you don't expect there to be lots of points that are, you know, 4 or 5 error bars away either. And so if you see this, and we'll get to another way to visualize this in a little bit, but if your line more or less goes through all of your data points, that's one way that you can assess whether the fit looks good. And that's probably the first one that you'll look at, because, you know, before anything else, these programs will give you a plot of your fit, and you can say, oh, that looks good, or, wow, that sucks. Okay? The second thing that you would do in trying to assess your fit is look at the actual value of the normalized chi-square. Okay? And so it turns out, if we go back to our definition of chi-square, There we go.
Let's suppose you have an average data point and you have an uncertainty for that data point. So my uncertainty for that data point, just for argument, is 1. And the difference between my data point and the model is also 1. Okay, so I would, in that case, this difference would be y minus x, that would be 1, divided by 1. And so your value for that particular point is going to be 1 divided by, well, number of degrees of freedom. And then you do the next point. And suppose that point, you know, it's an error bar, right? So on average, you expect your difference between your points and your fitted curve to be about an error bar in length, on that order of magnitude. And so the difference for that one is also going to be 1 divided by your error bar, which is 1. And so you get a contribution of 1 for that one. And so you do that, and suppose you have 130 points. Okay? Each one of them, on average, you would expect to be the difference between your data and your observed, your fit, would be on the same order of magnitude as your uncertainty for that particular point. And so for every single point, you get about a value of 1. And if you have 130 points, you get a value of about 130. But then you divide that by something that's proportional to the number of observations. Okay, so you might have 130 points, and so your number of observations would be 130, but if you have 2 parameters, you have 128. So that rounds to about 130. So we've gotten this sum that's equal to about 130, and we're dividing it by something that's almost equal to 130, and so we would expect our normalized chi-square, if all the statistics were playing in our favor, to be about equal to 1. Okay?
Certainly, if it's more than 1, then that's probably telling us that the fit isn't so good. Okay? And so, the lower the value is, the better.
And so here our chi-square is actually somewhat less than 1. But because of this statistical property of chi-squares that we just talked about, you know, you can actually estimate, you know, what's the probability that my model is, or that my data is described by this model, given chi-square, or given my normalized chi-square. And it turns out that if your normalized chi-square is 1 or less, the probability that the model describes the data is very, very high. If the reduced chi-square is greater than 1, it gets to be, you know, to the point where it doesn't, where you, the probability that your model describes the data is much lower. Okay, and so all of that to say, your second way for assessing a good fit is my reduced chi-square going to be about 1 or less? Okay, the third way is to look at the residuals. Okay, now the residuals are simply a difference between your data and the model itself. Okay, so you can imagine my residuals plot on this is simply my black point minus my red point at every single point. So here my residual is positive. Here my residual is negative. Here my residual is positive by about the order of the error bar. Here it's somewhat negative. Here it's pretty much dead on. And so all you're doing is you're subtracting your model from your observed data and looking at the small difference. Okay, and if it's a good fit, you're not going to see any kind of systematic trend in your residuals. You're not going to be over-predicting in any spot, and you're not going to be under-predicting in any spot. And indeed, if you look at this is your residuals plot for this fit, you see on average there's the same number of points above the line versus below the line. Nothing is terribly outside of the error bars, right? I mean, this guy is outside, but if you do enough points, you do enough observations, you expect by random chance one of them is going to be slightly bigger, one of them is going to be slightly less on average. In fact, I would say that this data fits too well, because nearly every single one is below the error bars, but that's quibbling. And the point is that you can look at a plot like this and immediately assess how well your curve agrees with your observed data. And so yes, you can look at your line and how well your line comes close to the individual points, but this is going to be a much more sensitive assessment. Certainly if it doesn't look good when you just compare your line to your data, your residuals plot's not going to look good. But there are situations where if you look at the line seems to fit the data just fine, but it's not until you actually look at the residuals until you can see a systematic trend.
Okay, so here's some examples. So in this case, the number of points below the line is greater than the number of points above the line, much, much greater. And so in this case, you're over-predicting your data. So that's no good. In this one, the number above and the number below are about equal, but you can see there's a big systematic jump. So the ones at the beginning are all over-predicted, the ones at the end are the ones that are under-predicted. And so using your residuals, using your chi-squared, using the look of the plot that Nuplot gives you, you can assess whether a curve is good or bad. And again, know whether you need to take it to your advisor. Okay, so now we've looked at some very simple models. This is another type of model. So if we think about single site binding, so two molecules coming together and forming a reversible association. Our observable here would be the degree of binding, and then this expression would relate our parameter, which is K, the equilibrium constant, to the initial protein, or the initial concentration of P, the initial concentration of L. Okay, so again, thinking about this from a model point of view, we specify our independent variables are P and L, and then K is our parameter, and what we actually observe, the dependent variable, is the degree of binding. Similarly, if we think about just a simple two-state type of transition.
So we have a transition, in this case, from N to U. The fraction in the N state, or the fraction folded here at N, is simply 1 over 1 plus K. But K, because it's a thermodynamic parameter, depends on the temperature. That's where the thermo comes in, the thermodynamic. And so we can relate K to delta H and delta S. And so here our parameters are expressed delta H, delta S. Temperature is an independent parameter, R is a constant, and so that's what we would modify. So again, two parameters, and this is our observable.
So you can see how we can build these things up. And scientifically, again, this might get a little bit beyond, particularly if you're an undergraduate researcher, you might not do this, in your summer project, but certainly as you develop, skills as a graduate student and you move on in chemistry, these are the type of things that biophysical researchers will do. And so they come up with hypotheses about a particular system, how a system works. In the examples we just talked about, how many binding sites are there? Is there cooperativity? How do we translate our qualitative hypotheses into something mathematical that we can test? And so that's the next step. We design an experiment that can produce the observables. So we make some measurements. We try to optimize our parameters and see if we get a good fit. If we get a good fit, then that model likely describes our data pretty well. If we don't get a good fit, well, then that model probably doesn't do so well. Maybe we need to revisit our model. And then ultimately, you would want to step out of this circle and see if your model can make predictions about new situations. So you've collected some data, you've optimized your parameters, things seem to make sense, but now let's see if we can stretch our model into maybe a different set of concentrations or a different set of temperatures.
and then see if our model continues to make sense. The more and more you do that, the more and more confident you become that the model that you've proposed is the correct one.
Okay, so to summarize, before we ask questions, you know, when we're thinking about biochemical models, and maybe the paradigm shift for you guys is going to be moving into a point where we use models as a way of quantifying observations. So models are usually a set of equations that allow us to predict the behavior of a particular biological system. You know, given this particular set of concentrations, is our cell going to stay in S phase, or is it going to start dividing and proliferating? You know, those types of things are our models that allow us to predict the outcomes of particular situations. Models always have fitting parameters, and so those parameters are typically not known, and so we optimize the parameters to give us the best agreement between our observation and the model values. And then finally, you know, we can use programs like Nuplot. And again, I have no intention of being able to teach you Nuplot. That's why you have this. So programs like Nuplot, MATLAB, Mathematica, they all have the same kind of features. They can be used as a simple tool to optimize the agreement between your data and your model by changing the parameters. And so again, this is your homework for tonight. And once you've done that, then you have some idea about what your parameters are and what the statistical strengths and weaknesses of those parameters are as well. Okay, I know this was probably another mind-blowing session for some of you. Everybody mind blown? Yeah. Okay, good. That's what you're here for. So again, I don't expect you to be experts in model fitting after one, you know, hour and 10-minute lecture. But, you know, by thinking about these things and getting into a point where you practice doing some model fitting, and there's some examples here. So there's an example on fitting a straight line here and how you generate a residuals plot. So you can use this to practice. And I'm happy to give you more data if you want more data to practice with. But this will get you sort of in a position where now you can be dangerously useful to your undergraduate research lab and have an idea on what goes into, you know, model fitting. Remember the Excel example. That Excel workbook is online. Download that and play with it. Because really that's all a computer is doing. It's essentially playing with numbers and trying to minimize another target function. Okay, questions?